Good evening. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian. Welcome to the Society Library. I'm glad you came out on a rather stormy day. Though I'm from Canada, so that's nothing, as I told some people this morning. But I'm sure there's more of winter to come. Let me remind you that if you have a cell phone or a pager or a laptop or anything that's going to make a noise, if you could just take it out and turn it off for the next hour, we would appreciate it. Contributions are tax deductible here at the library, and they're very helpful at this time of the year during our fall annual appeal. Thank you to all of you who have made a contribution already, and if the rest of you are inclined to do so, please remember it helps us to have evenings like this, run our children's library, do all kinds of great things, including buy lots of print books. Thomas Fleming is the author of more than 50 books, both historical nonfiction and fiction, including most recently The Intimate Lives of the Founding Fathers, The Secret Trial of Robert E. Lee, and The Perils of Peace, America's Struggles for Survival After Yorktown. His many honors include the Burick Prize for Lifetime Achievement from Boston University and the 2012 Gomez Mill House Pioneer Prize. He is the only writer in the history of the Book of the Month Club to have main selections in both fiction and nonfiction. And last week, Mr. Fleming was pleased to tell me on the weekend that he spoke to the Philadelphia Roundtable of the American Revolution, and he was given the Benjamin Franklin Award for Lifetime Achievement, which has been given to only four other historians. So congratulations, Mr. Fleming. Mr. Fleming is the son of a local politician in Jersey City, and he's had a lifelong interest in American politics and history. Military history is certainly his strongest interests, and critics have been praising his wonderful new book, A Disease in the Public Mind. The Wall Street Journal has said, "A great deal of fine scholarship, a superbly revisionist book." And the Weekly Standard adds, "It comes as a relief when a historian of the stature of Mr. Fleming takes it upon himself to set the record straight about the complex, irresistible causes of the Civil War. Well-researched and well-documented. A splendid story." Our friends from the Corner Bookstore are outside in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery, and they'll be happy to sell you a copy of the book after. Books make great holiday presents, so do pick up a copy, and Mr. Fleming would be happy to sign a book after for you or just shake your hand and share some more stories. So it's really my great pleasure to welcome one of the Society Library's cherished member writers, Thomas Fleming.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, and I too will extend my congratulations for everybody who had the nerve to come tonight, even though outside it isn't that bad now, but it certainly looked that way in this morning. And also, again, I'd like to express my pleasure, which I often do when I speak here, but there's something perfect about talking about history at the Society Library. You feel it's the topic for this place. And this book, I think, is, in some respects, history with a capital H. Some books storm into a writer's mind with the force of a hurricane or an earthquake. I've had that happen. I woke up in the middle of the night once, and I heard George Washington talking to me, believe it or not. And they didn't take me away in the morning, either. But others are journeys that grow slowly over the course of years, sometimes making a writer feel like a pilgrim, searching for a shrine he fears may not exist. A Disease in the Public Mind is one of those pilgrimage books. It has a message that's especially important at the Civil War's 150th anniversary. The war was a tragedy for which neither North nor South should be blamed. Instead, the terrible sacrifices of the men and women who were engulfed by it should make us resolve to do our utmost to detect and root out contemporary diseases of the public mind and understand others beyond this particular set that we're going to talk about tonight. I came upon the phrase, a disease in the public mind, while writing an article about John Brown's 1859 raid on Harper's Ferry. At that point, most of my history books had been about the era of the American Revolution, Brown was new historical territory for me. I was startled to discover that this gray-bearded 59-year-old planned to take command of an army of slaves equipped with the 100,000 rifles in the federal arsenal at the ferry, as the town was called. In Brown's luggage were carefully drawn maps identifying the counties of the South where blacks outnumbered whites. These were his targets. Equally surprising was the discovery that Captain Brown, as he called himself, was defeated and captured by U.S. Marines led by Colonel Robert E. Lee, the most famous soldier in the American Army of that time. At Brown's headquarters in nearby Maryland, Lee found letters that revealed six wealthy Northerners had armed Brown and his men with the Sharps rifles that killed innocent citizens in Harper's Ferry, including the town's anti-slavery mayor and a free black man. That's one of the great ironies. Brown's subsequent trial and execution stirred violent emotions, North and South. President James Buchanan blamed the crisis on a disease in the public mind. I couldn't get that phrase out of my head. What did it mean? I soon discovered that the concept of the public mind had a long and respectable history. George Washington, John Adams, Abraham Lincoln, and many other leaders used it when discussing politics. At one point, Washington lamented that Patrick Henry's opposition to the Constitution had soured the public mind of Virginia. Lincoln said Northerners had debauched the public mind of the South to convince people that the secession was legal. In a 1952 presidential election, the Democratic candidate for whom I voted, Adlai Stevenson, said, "Those who corrupt the public mind are just as evil as those who steal from the public." The term public mind, I slowly realized, describes something much less fluctuating than public opinion. That can change as swiftly as the weather. The public mind involved fixed beliefs that were fundamental to the way people saw the world of their time. A disease in the public mind was and is a twisted interpretation of political or economic or spiritual realities, or all three together, that seizes control of thousands and even millions of people. In the book, I have a number of other public minds, such as communism and Nazism, which are good examples of how this whole thing works. America first experienced one of these episodes in 1692, when the leaders of the Massachusetts Bay Colony became convinced that witches were threatening their society with evil powers. Over 200 people were arrested and flung into fetid jails. 21 were hanged. One 71-year-old man was pressed to death beneath heavy stones. No one has described this frenzy better than the great New England novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne. "That terrible delusion," he wrote, "should teach us, among its other morals, that the influential classes are fully liable to all the passionate error that has ever characterized the maddest mobs. Clergymen, judges, statesmen, the wisest, calmest, holiest persons of their day, stood in the inner circle, round about the gallows, loudest to acclaim the work of blood, latest to confess themselves miserably deceived." John Brown stirred similar unreality in the best people of the North in 1859. They showered praise on a fanatic who believed, and I quote, "Without the emission of blood, there is no forgiveness for sin." In Kansas, a few years earlier, Brown had murdered six unarmed Southerners before the horrified eyes of their wives and children, and ordered his sons to hack up their bodies with cavalry swords. After Brown's execution, America's best-known writer, Ralph Waldo Emerson, declared him the equal of Jesus Christ. Another inflamed Massachusetts man told Emerson that compared to John Brown, Christ was a dead failure. He had ignored three decades of Northern prayers begging him to end slavery. John, Albion, Andrew, a forgotten but very important character, the governor of Massachusetts, declared the South had to be conquered, though it cost a million lives. The governor's war cry became a blood-soaked prophecy. The Civil War caused more deaths, more heartbreak, than our nation suffered in all its other wars combined. It created what historian Drew Gilpin Faust has called the Republic of Suffering, a tidal wave of grief and loss that tormented the nation for decades. Even more shocking to me was the realization that the United States was the only nation in the world that fought such a horrendous war to end slavery. All the countries of South America, even Brazil, which had 3 million slaves, almost as many as America's 4 million, ended the evil institution peacefully. The British freed almost 1 million slaves in the West Indies without bloodshed. Revolutionary France ended slavery in their colonies with a decree from Paris. A great deal of blood was later shed in the colony we call Haiti. But it was spilled when one of history's great monsters, Napoleon Bonaparte, tried to reimpose slavery. How could this avalanche of death happen in the United States of America, governed by men supposedly elected to respond to the voice or voices of the people? To answer this question became the goal of the book I decided to write. Soon I had chapter after chapter of Americans who struggled with the dilemma of slavery. One of the most touching stories was about John Woolman, the New Jersey Quaker, who urged Americans in 1750 to end the slave trade and find a way to peacefully free its victims. Woolman didn't blame anyone for slavery. He knew it had existed for 2,000 years and was sanctioned in the Bible. He simply tried to tell slave owners why inhuman bondage troubled him so deeply. In his later years, John Woolman wore white clothing. He refused to use dyes made from indigo harvested by slave labor in the West Indies. He went to England, where his bizarre appearance in all white clothes prompted one leading Quaker, a prominent physician, to suggest he should go home as soon as possible. After Woolman calmly explained his mission, the doctor apologized for his remarks. A few months later, John Woolman died of smallpox in northern England, apparently an eccentric failure. But his journal, reprinted dozens of times, became the seed that inspired a future generation of Britons to free those almost 1 million West Indies slaves peacefully by paying their owners $1 billion. Another chapter features one of my biggest historical surprises to me, as well as to other people, George Washington as an emancipator. In 1775, he was impressed by the numerous black men who told him they wanted to fight for America's independence. General Washington accepted them in the Continental Army. By the end of the Revolutionary War, 1 in every 7 men and the Continental Army was black. Those soldiers were only a tiny percentage of the 500,000 black Americans who remained in bondage in 1776. The man who awoke Washington to the moral dimensions of their hard fate was the idealistic French volunteer, the Marquis de Lafayette. The childless Washington grew very fond of this young man, who called him my adopted father. More than once, Lafayette told Washington he would never have drawn his sword if he'd known he was helping to found a republic of slavery. Soon Washington began recognizing the legitimacy of slave marriages at Mount Vernon. He made capable black men overseers of several of his farms and rewarded them for doing a good job. During his presidency, he seriously considered giving freedom to all his slaves and calling on other Americans to imitate his example. He corresponded for almost a year with a very gifted British agricultural expert. His plan was to sell 4/5 of Mount Vernon to very skilled farmers that he was going to bring in from England. and then free all the slaves, and they would work as hired men on these farms for these sort of senior farmers, I guess you'd call them. But he finally had to give up on the idea. Angry political divisions about other matters, especially the French Revolution, which Thomas Jefferson and he came to an almost fatal clash over, made him fear a quarrel over slavery would rupture what he called the fraternal affection that linked Americans North and South and destroy the still fragile American Union. And here was, I think, one of the key things we don't realize about Washington's greatness. More than almost anybody, he saw the crucial importance of the Union in making the United States a unique country. If the states had split up and three states formed a country and four states formed a country, the next thing you know, they would have been fighting wars, and we would have been another Europe. We would have had alliances with France and with England and so forth. And the vision of America that he had fought for and saw as a possibility, he repeated this again and again while he was general. For instance, in 1781, after Yorktown, he said, "I see one head turning into 13. He fought for this idea of the Union. It was his great gift to the country, and that's why it meant so much to him. So he made a compromise. He freed all his slaves in his will, and he ordered each man and woman to be educated and trained in a skill that would enable them to live respectable lives. Now, here was something that everybody and almost everybody else in the South just didn't think was possible. And he was telling them, yes, they can be trained, they can be taught to read, write, acquire skills, and so forth. And it was really an amazing development and a marvelous step toward possibly freeing the slaves peacefully. But the shock of his sudden death, he became ill in the morning, he was dead that night. It totally obscured this lonely emancipation. It went largely unnoticed. And that's why I decided to call Washington our forgotten emancipator. Two other chapters explore Thomas Jefferson, whose passionate detestation of slavery shines through the Declaration of Independence. But this emotion was tragically corrupted by Jefferson's pseudo-scientific conviction that blacks were inferior to whites and nourished resentments that would make it dangerous to free them. In 1801, soon after he became president, a French diplomat persuaded Jefferson to approve an invasion of the island of Santo Domingo. The new ruler of France, Napoleon Bonaparte, wanted to regain control of the French half of the island to reap the profits of its fertile soil. It was currently being governed by a gifted former slave, Toussaint Louverture, another forgotten hero of American history, I think. A tiny buzzing creature, the female mosquito, whose bite inflicted yellow fever, destroyed the French army after a year of vicious no-quarter warfare. An enraged black leader, General Jean-Jacques Dessalines, killed every surviving French white man, woman, and child, and declared himself the leader of a new country, Haiti. This tragedy became Thomas Jefferson's nightmare, a race war. The appalled president persuaded Congress to pass a resolution, refusing to recognize Haiti's independence. His own son-in-law, John Epps, married to his younger daughter, introduced this. He was a congressman. He introduced this resolution, and here's how seriously they took it. Epps looked around Congress, and he said, "Is there anyone so base as to disagree with this resolution?" Guess what? It passed unanimously, and henceforth, all political contact with the new black nation ended. For the next 58 years, the United States tried to pretend Haiti didn't exist. The first president to send a diplomat to Haiti was Abraham Lincoln in 1862. But reports of the extermination of the white population permeated the public mind of the American South. Jefferson's attempt to put this over the horizon in the middle of the ocean just didn't work. When John Brown's wealthy backers were revealed, numerous Southern leaders declared these people wanted to inflict another Santo Domingo on us. I read this phrase in the editorials of at least six prominent Southern newspapers after John Brown's episode. It was by no means the first time Southerners had used these words. They revealed that Thomas Jefferson's nightmare had persisted in the South's public mind for more than a half century. In the meantime, President Jefferson unintentionally launched another disease of the public mind. After the failure of the invasion of Santo Domingo, Napoleon abandoned his plan to restore the French Empire in America. He sold the immense territory of Louisiana, almost a third of the continent, to the United States. New England's leaders objected angrily to the Louisiana purchase. They foresaw that this huge expansion would reduce their section of the nation to a tiny minority. They were outraged. They were the people who had begun the American Revolution. They regarded themselves as the nation's rightful leaders. Timothy Pickering, one of the most right-wing characters that ever strode the American stage, he tried to convince everybody that Jefferson couldn't buy Louisiana unless every state in the Union approved it. But Jefferson said, thank you very much, and he got a majority in Congress, and they bought it. 3 years later came President Jefferson's embargo. These two things are connected. To avoid war with an aggressive England, which was locked in a no-quarter struggle with Napoleon's France, Jefferson prohibited all trade with both nations. The embargo had a catastrophic impact on New England, whose ships carried most of America's cargo. Merchants went bankrupt by the dozen. 40,000 unemployed sailors seethed and rioted in her ports. The already angry New Englanders began to see Southerners as arrogant, uncaring enemies instead of fellow Americans. And note, this precedes any discussion of slavery. This was an antagonism that Jefferson, I think he should have seen it coming, but he didn't, unwittingly created in this wild idea of creating, of legislating this embargo. The depth of this antagonism became vividly evident in the War of 1812. The New England states did everything in their power to cripple the Southerner in the White House, President James Madison. They refused to let their state militias serve in the U.S. Army. They openly traded with the enemy. Finally, they called a convention in Hartford to discuss seceding from the Union. The war ended before New England could make good on this threat, but peace did nothing to moderate their animosity toward the South. Their hostility soon focused on the South's moral flaw, the persistence and the growth of slavery as cotton became a hugely profitable crop. New Englanders began challenging the admission of new states that tolerated slavery. They were just trying to make trouble for the South and stop them from taking over the country, too. In 1819, a dispute over Missouri brought the federal government to a virtual halt and elicited an anguished cry from the 76-year-old Jefferson. We have the wolf by the ears, and we can neither hold him nor let him go. He was still in the grip of his race nightmare. A decade later, a Boston newspaper man named William Lloyd Garrison began publishing The Liberator, a paper that called for the immediate emancipation of all the South slaves. Hatred for the South was deep in Garrison's soul. Jefferson's embargo had bankrupted his merchant sailor father and destroyed his parents' marriage. Garrison combined his call for instant emancipation with the assertion that slavery was the equivalent of rape, a crime which he accused slave owners of constantly committing. Garrison claimed he was inspired by God to make this stance. Slavery itself was a sin. Wasn't it logical that it would be the fountainhead of other sins? Soon, numerous New Englanders became converts to this lethal mixture of religion and politics, a danger that the nation's founders had done their utmost to avoid. New England's hatred of the South permeated the abolitionist anti-slavery speeches and pamphlets and newspaper stories. To white Southerners, this verbal abuse poisoned the call to free black men and women from bondage. No one described the impact of this disease in the public mind better than Thomas Jefferson's grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph. He was a fascinating guy. He was 6'4", but twice as wide as Jefferson, but a very passionate idealist. Jefferson died $1 million in debt. Thomas Jefferson Randolph spent 20 years in comparative poverty, paying back every cent of this debt. In 1833, 7 years after his grandfather's death, he proposed a program of gradual emancipation in the Virginia legislature. After a furious debate in which an astonishing number of prominent Virginians admitted slavery was a curse, Randolph lost by only 5 votes. He immediately ran for re-election, determined to renew the struggle. But it was a year later now, and he got nowhere. The abolitionists had begun flooding Virginia with pamphlets and broadsides that revealed what Randolph called their morbid hatred of the Southern white man. The opportunity for a rational debate about slavery had vanished beyond recall. Around this time, another man was beginning his political career in Illinois. Abraham Lincoln summed up his philosophy in words that were the total opposite of the abolitionist approach. If you would win a man to your cause, Lincoln said, first convince him you are his sincere friend. Therein is a drop of honey that catches his heart. The abolitionists were incapable of this generosity. In 1831, a deranged slave preacher named Nat Turner called on his followers to imitate Santo Domingo and kill every white person they encountered. William Lloyd Garrison did not say a word of sympathy for the bereaved families and friends of Turner's victims. Although Garrison claimed to disapprove of violence, he came close to gloating over the carnage. Perhaps the most revealing evidence of the abolitionist's fatal flaw is a sort of contrary way to look at it through the career of Theodore Dwight Weld. I have to confess I had never heard of him when I discovered him. For a decade, this Connecticut-born dynamo, he was big, another Jefferson Randolph type, but with a wild head of hair, and you could just see him up on in a pulpit converting tens of thousands of people in the Midwest to anti-slavery with his blazing sermons. But in the mid-1840s, Weld suddenly asked himself how a professed Christian could preach hatred. Theodore Dwight Weld withdrew from the abolitionist crusade and never said another word against the South or Southerners. Meanwhile, William Lloyd Garrison went from extreme to extreme. He burned the Constitution in public because it tolerated slavery. He urged the North to secede from a South infested with the evil of slavery. He called for changing the name of the nation's capital because George Washington was a slave owner and was undoubtedly writhing in the flames of hell. He obviously heard nothing, knew nothing about Washington freeing his slaves. Soon, a paranoid myth called a slave power infested thousands of northern minds. These true believers compared the South to the Antichrist. Others said it was the apocalyptic dragon of the Book of Revelation rising to strangle freedom in the North as it had extinguished it in the South. Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts summed up this fanaticism in a single sentence. "Are you for freedom or slavery?" he shouted to a Boston audience. "Are you for God or the devil?" To complete their portrait of a morally degraded South, the abolitionists also insisted that slavery had bankrupted the region. Its soil was exhausted. Most of the people lived in abject poverty. Only the 6% who owned slaves were wealthy. In fact, the South was by far the richest section of the nation. Six of the 10 wealthiest states in the American Union were Southern. One of my book's most surprising chapters is titled The Real Uncle Tom and the Unknown South He Helped to Create. The real Tom was Josiah Hanson, H-E-N-S-O-N, who was as shrewd and self-confident as the fictional Tom was stupid and cringing. Hanson ran his master's Maryland farm and made twice as much money as the white overseer he replaced. Hanson was not some miraculous exception. An amazing percentage of the South's plantations had black overseers. Many landowners had begun paying these men and their workers to improve their performance. In cities like Charleston and New Orleans, over half the artisans, tailors, shoemakers, carpenters, were black. Slavery was changing. It remained a monstrously unjust institution, but the seeds of American freedom were visible in so many places. At the same time, each night on the roads of the South, armed men drafted from the militia patrolled with orders to challenge every black man they met. Thomas Jefferson's nightmare remained a cancer in the South's public mind. Eliminating slavery peacefully would never have been easy or swift, but the possibility was visible until John Brown and his backers made further progress impossible. Robert E. Lee lived through these firestorms of public emotion as an officer in the U.S. Army. Many people considered him George Washington's heir. His father had been Light Horse Harry Lee, the most famous cavalry leader in the Revolution. At Washington's funeral, he was the man who said he was first in peace, first in war, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. Colonel Lee was married to Mary Custis, Washington's great-granddaughter. It was uncanny the way history involved Lee in the quarrel over slavery. He and his wife were living in Fortress Monroe in Virginia when Nat Turner's revolt exploded only a few miles away. When his wife inherited over 100 slaves from her father with orders to eventually free them, Lee took a leave of absence from the Army to help her deal with this difficult legacy. The Custis Mansion, as many of you know, it's named Arlington, overlooked and still overlooks Washington, D.C. The colonel's proximity was what made panicky President Buchanan choose him to deal with John Brown at Harper's Ferry. Lee had no solution to the dilemma of slavery beyond the hope of gradual emancipation inspired by George Washington's example. As he struggled to deal with the restless, not yet freed slaves at Arlington, there were all kinds of financial problems connected with the estate that made it impossible to free them immediately. Abolitionists published a savage smear in a Washington newspaper. They accused him of stripping a black woman slave, who had run away, and personally whipping her. Meanwhile, the frenzy generated by John Brown split the Union. Abraham Lincoln was elected as an anti-slavery Republican president with only 40% of the vote, virtually all from the North. Thomas Jefferson's nightmare soon reigned supreme in the seven states of the Deep South. They seceded and called for the border states to join them. To everyone's amazement, the self-educated Illinois lawyer in the White House was equal to this ultimate presidential challenge. In unspoken imitation of Washington, Lincoln saw the Union as his primary concern. There's a wonderful book that's published only last year by Gary Gallagher called The Union War, in which he demonstrates as many as 75 to 80% of all the Northerners who fought in the Civil War fought to save the Union, not the free slavery. So Lincoln, as I said, saw this as his primary concern. He stunned abolitionists by declaring that if he could save the Union without freeing a single slave, he'd do it. He insisted, though, that these words did not alter his personal detestation of slavery. This was the president's guiding principle in his decision to resupply besieged Fort Sumter, the federal fort in Charleston's harbor. He was determined to uphold the supremacy of the Union, in this case being challenged in this particular fort. when the men of the Deep South opened fire on Lincoln's ships, Lincoln summoned an army of 75,000 volunteers to put down a now violent rebellion. The president remained keenly aware that Virginia, the largest southern state, had not seceded, nor had its satellite state, North Carolina. In an immensely daring move, Lincoln offered Colonel Robert E. Lee command of the army he had summoned to suppress the rebellion. Suddenly, I was confronting one of the most dramatic and least known turning points in America's history. Winfield Scott, the general who had seen Lee in action in the Mexican War, was the current commander of the regular army. Scott was in complete agreement with the president's offer. He said Lee was worth 50,000 men. Like other southern states, Virginia had summoned a convention to decide whether to secede. Many people felt their decision depended on what Colonel Lee would do. In the most agonizing decision of his life, Robert E. Lee said no to Lincoln's offer. The abolitionist campaign of slander and insult against Southern white men and his discovery of John Brown's six secret backers had ravaged his loyalty to the Union. He didn't see how he could command an army full of men who hated Southerners. After two more tormented days and nights, Colonel Lee resigned from the U.S. Army and became commander of Virginia's forces. And behind the scenes was the brains that helped the South win the Battle of Bull Run. As the war began its harvest of death on both sides, Abraham Lincoln tried to save the Union without yielding to the abolitionist call for the South's destruction. Again and again, he tried to persuade the secessionists to accept a plan of gradual emancipation in which the masses would be paid for their slaves. He was obviously aware of the way this solution had prevented bloodshed in the West Indies. The abolitionists heaped unbelievable abuse on Lincoln for this policy. One of his most savage critics was the Boston aristocrat, Wendell Phillips. He compared Lincoln to a dim-witted turtle. In New Jersey, where I don't believe there were too many aristocrats, Lincoln was called the brainless bobolink of the prairies. That's my native state. That always makes me wince. But Lincoln never wavered from his chosen course. When he issued the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, he preceded it with a final offer for compensated emancipation. There was not a word in the document that suggested hatred or a desire to punish the South. It was issued in the name of the president's paramount duty to save the Union. In two clauses, Lincoln confronted Thomas Jefferson's nightmare and linked his policy to the forgotten emancipator, George Washington. He urged black Americans to refrain from violence and find honest employment when they were freed, and he announced he would accept black volunteers in the Union Army. Lincoln knew he was following George Washington's example here. In 1862, an historian named George Livermore had published a book on black participation in the American Revolution. The president gave him one of the pens with which he signed the Emancipation Proclamation. I thought my exploration of the tragedy of the Civil War was over when I read those clauses in the proclamation. But I was wrong. I found a book that revealed the depth and intensity of Lincoln's hope for reconciling North and South and in achieving a rebirth of that fraternal affection George Washington had seen as the key to America's union. Another word for that phrase is brotherhood. The book was entitled Impressions of Lincoln. It connected Lincoln to Washington in an amazing way. The author was the Marquis de Chambrun, a grandson of the Marquis de Lafayette, the man who first awakened Washington to slavery's evil. In 1865, the French government sent Chambrun to America to repair the two countries' historic friendship, which had been badly strained during the war. The affable Marquis, he had all his grandfather's charm, became a favorite of Mrs. Lincoln and was a constant visitor in the White House. The Lincolns invited Chambrun to join them on a trip to the Union Army camp in Virginia. were now in 1865. The trip included a visit to Richmond, the recently captured capital of the almost defeated Confederacy. Chamberlain described Lincoln walking through the city's wrecked, littered streets while freed black men and women cried out their gratitude. As I read this story in the Marquis's memoir, I saw the forgotten emancipator, George Washington, and his adopted son, Lafayette, beside Lincoln in spirit. On the trip back to Washington, D.C., President Lincoln expressed his dismay at the devastation he had seen in Richmond. He spoke of his desire to heal the terrible wounds of the war and reconcile the hostile sections. As they approached the city, the Capitol's dome loomed in the distance. Mrs. Lincoln pointed to it and told her husband that he had enemies who would not let him achieve this peace of reconciliation. She was talking about the numerous abolitionist politicians in Congress who were calling for the execution of Robert E. Lee and other Southern leaders. Enemies, Lincoln said. His lined, weary face came aglow with a smile that was tinged with sadness. He was aware of these vengeance seekers, but he was confident he could deal with them. He shook his head and replied in words that again joined hands with George Washington's vision of an American Union unstained by slavery, committed and reunited in fraternal affection. Enemies, Lincoln said, we must never use that word again. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Now I'll take a drink. I was afraid I was going to spill it all over the the podium. Yes.
You said that Jefferson felt that the black people of the South were inferior.
Yes.
And yet he had this very long affair with Sally Hemings.
Well, that's I hate to do an about face, but that is what we suppose. A great many people now suppose, but it hasn't been proven.
I thought it was proven with DNA.
No, that DNA is not the DNA that proves, you know, if I shot my wife right here and then fled, they could use my DNA to prove that I did it, you know, and so forth. But that DNA proves that a man, it proves the identity of a person out of 2 billion possible suspects. But the kind of DNA that connected Jefferson to Sally Hemings was through her son. And that only proved that some descendant of Sally Hemings' name, who had her male, had gotten his male DNA through her ancestors and so forth. So any one of Jefferson's relatives could have been the father of this son. And there were 20 people with Jefferson DNA in the immediate vicinity of Monticello.
Forgive me, I just wanted to say one more thing. I thought that there was a great resemblance.
Oh, yes, the
resemblance
is...
Jefferson, even the red hair.
Yes, well, no. That one of Sally's sons had the red hair, yeah, but not the man who made the big confession. But there was another Jefferson relative. Well, I recommend that. I have it's over there on the side... sideboard there. I wrote a book, The Intimate Lives of the Founding Fathers, and I go into this in two chapters about how this all worked and how this came to be and so forth. Nonetheless, but let me again do an about face, though, and say, yes, that there was something special about the Hemings family. They were Jefferson's, what shall I say, Jefferson's wife's father was their parent, so all of Jefferson's children were. You only had two daughters that lived. They were all related to the Hemings, and that's one of the reasons why Jefferson treated them very, very well. Whether or not he had the affair with Sally, the first lawsuit that Jefferson ever tried in 1750, when he got his law degree in his hand for the first time, was in a courtroom where he was trying to get a mulatto who freed, whose grandmother, was black, and But for the next two generations, everyone in his family tree were white. And Jefferson claimed this man deserved to be free. But under Virginia law, it wasn't possible, and the judge threw Jefferson and the case out of court. But he believed very much that after two generations that a mulatto person should be freed, even though he had original black blood in his veins. And that is why the Hemings got such very special treatment, and he freed them all. He never did free Sally, though, at when he died. Yeah, so it's a... Yes, ma'am. I think the embargo it was really crucial in convincing the New Englanders that Jefferson really didn't care what happened to them. And they enlarged that to say Southerners didn't care, because Madison was his Secretary of State, and then Madison became the president. You know, they really did. And then Monroe was another Jefferson disciple. So they really did feel that through 12 years of Jeffersonian presidents that gave the South a lot of time to brood about it all and see that this was this hostility was deep in the Southern soul. So that really had a lot to do with triggering their eagerness to believe in the worst about the South. Yes? Yeah, it's okay. You're talking about the riots in the Civil War? Oh yeah. That was mostly conducted by my ancestors, the Irish. But they were very angry because they feared that by freeing the blacks, that they were going to come up to New York and take away jobs that they had, and this was not a period when there was any safety nets around. There was no Social Security or unemployment insurance. You lost a job, you were in a lot of trouble. And so they really felt that there was they felt hatred for these blacks because they saw them as threats to their well-being, you know. And also, they had nothing to do with slavery or all that. They were recent immigrants, you know. And so it was a very complicated feeling about it all. Yes, sir.
In your opinion, if Grant had not given the parole to all Southern soldiers, do you think the radical Republicans would have hung them?
I think that they certainly would have hanged Lee. I have a novel over there. One of my more recent books is called The Secret Trial of Robert E. Lee, and it's based on something that didn't happen. It's a what-if, counterfactual, but it was there. You can see why it could have happened, because in June of 1865, a federal grand jury indicted General Lee for treason. And when Grant heard this, he said, if that man goes to trial, I'm going to resign as commander-in-chief of the Union Army. And President Johnson, Lincoln's successor, Lincoln had been dead for several months, he panicked and said, "That get rid of that indictment," and the indictment just went away. But that was their intent, and you'll see this. I explore this at great length, and not too great. I think you'd enjoy reading it, but I explore this in considerable detail. Why they wanted to feel Lee was their favorite, the target of the abolitionists after the war, because. And we can all testify to this. He personified this dignity and this honor, the sense of honor which the South managed to preserve in the midst of this terrible war. And I wrote a history of West Point, I discovered this scene in that when Lee decided that the war was for his army was over, and he said, "I think we may have to go to General Lee and ask for General Grant and ask for terms." And And all his the people around him and on his staff, the young, most all young, said, "Don't do that, General. Let's scatter into the woods and we'll fight a guerrilla war and we'll fight for another 100 years." And Lee said, "No, no, no. We're not going to do that. The men would have no standards, no orders, no nothing. This would be a disaster for the country." And they said, "But General Lee, General Grant is going to insist on unconditional surrender." This is what the abolitionists were calling for at this point. And they didn't know that Grant had already conferred with Lincoln about this. But Lee, interestingly, he knew nothing about that fact. But he, as a fellow West Pointer, he said, "General Grant will give us the honorable terms this army deserves." And that's exactly what he did. So I think that's one of the great stories of American history. Yes, sir.
Both the commander of the Union Army and the commander of the Virginia militia. Is that correct? Or had he, he really resigned from the Union Army before he took the commission in Virginia?
He did. He did resign, yes. Generals, I think it's in this book. I've written a lot of scenes about this man, but General Scott said to Lee, when Lee told him he went to see him and said, I'm not going to, I can't do it. I just won't accept the offer. And Scott said, "You have made the worst mistake of your life, Lee." And then there was a long silence as the two of them brooded because they were very, very close friends. And then Scott said to him, "You have to resign." This was in the regulations. Lee was a full colonel in the American Army. And under the Articles of War or whatever we call it, but the Army's rules, when you are offered another appointment and you're on duty, you know, you're in the regular Army, and you turn down that appointment, you have to resign. That's all there is to it. You can't go, I say, "Well, I don't want that job, I'll be a colonel." You're ordered, especially when the President of the United States makes the offer. And so he had definitely, he did resign, but it took him another 2 days to send the letter in resigning. And then he went to Richmond and became head of the head of their militia, their army. Yeah. That's, yes.
Could you go over again the importance of the embargo?
It's the embargo seemed to the New Englanders to be aimed mostly at them. It wasn't completely. New York suffered horribly from it because they were a big busy port too. Although one of the things I think New Yorkers don't realize is how many Southerners came to, how many New Englanders lived in New York by this time. They knew where the money was, you know, and they came down by the dozens, by the hundreds and so forth. But at any rate, they were the people who suffered by far the most. The South did not have a big commercial, you know, there was no merchantmen or anything that owned by Southerners. So it was Madison. It was Madison's idea, actually, but Jefferson thought it was a wonderful idea, too. And they thought it was an answer to war. But the British soon found other sources for American food. By this time, they had developed India, and they had lots of places around the world where they could get food. This shocked Madison and Jefferson terribly that they didn't blink an eye. The British didn't, you know. They just kept on fighting and got their supplies elsewhere. And so it didn't work. And then so that on his last day in office, this connects to a book I'm writing right now. I'm doing a book on the clash between Washington and Jefferson when Washington was president. But when Jefferson was president, he became so discouraged when the embargo failed that he more or less resigned as president, although he stayed in the White House. He shipped all his furniture back to Monticello, and he let Madison run the country. And on the last day in office, he sent a message to Congress saying, "If you have a solution, go to it. I don't have the answer," which I really think was a terrible thing for a president to do, to resign power. Washington would have spun in his grave about 10 times to think of anybody doing something like this, because Washington was the man who created the strong presidency, you know. So that's the background on that. Yes, sir. There were a few. Yes, yes. Right, right, yeah. Well, the thing that really brought on the Civil War was not so much William Lloyd Garrison and his instant emancipation, but the Northern decision not to allow the South to take slaves into the territories. And this brings us into a really crucial question. It was too complicated to get into in a talk. But James Madison, who I think is probably the smartest politician we've ever had anywhere, he analyzed the situation in terms of slavery, as the problem was diffusion. The northern states, New York had the highest percentage of any northern state of slaves. We had 14% of New Yorkers were slaves during the Revolution. But that still is not a very high percentage. But the South, by 1860, 40% of their population was enslaved. And Madison saw that there was a tipping point where diffusion had to happen, or we'd have either one or two things. You'd have a slave revolt, which they had in the several West Indies islands, or you'd have a horrible regime of slavery in which the slaves were reduced to, treated unbelievably badly and so forth, and constant watching to make sure they didn't revolt. But this diffusion, the inability to achieve this diffusion and take the slaves into the territories, I think that had a lot to do with bringing on the Civil War. The South, I have a whole chapter in the book about President John Tyler. He succeeded William Henry Harrison in 1840. Harrison died after a month in office, and Tyler was from Virginia, a very bright man, and he did a lot of very interesting things, but in 1859 and 1860, he was one of the first to bring up this question of diffusion. And if we can't have diffusion, we're going to have to secede. The county in which he lived in Virginia, Prince Charles County, I think that's what it was called. Anyway, a name like that. They already slaves outnumbered whites in that county 4-1. And he said, I am not going to sit here and wait until slaves outnumber my, he had about 5 kids by his second wife, and he said, I'm not going to sit here until slaves outnumber whites 10 or 15-1, and then we're all going to get killed. And he said, we've got to do something about this. And that's, so he tried to, he set up a peace convention after the South seceded, and they tried to work out some kind of a deal. But it just wasn't possible. The New England states, that quote I have from Governor John Albion Andrew in Massachusetts, really was very, a very significant quote. They had decided that they were going to go to war and destroy the South. They were convinced that these Southerners were a bunch of effete jerks, and these God-inspired New Englanders could just run right over them, And boy, did they get a shock at Bull Run. Yes.
What percentage of Southerners were
slaveholders? 6%. Yeah, yeah. And it really was not a huge percentage, no. Which, this is very puzzling, but that's one of the reasons why the South lost the war, though, because you maybe have heard the phrase, it was a rich man's war and a poor man's fight. And by the time the South surrendered, something like 150,000 men in their army had deserted. I mean, there really was an impact of the fact that they didn't own slaves, so It's amazing how complicated it all is. Yes, could we have one more question, maybe?
Could you speculate on what would have happened if Lincoln had not been assassinated?
Now, this lady has asked a tremendously terrific, wonderful question, she wants to know if we could think about a little what would have happened if Lincoln hadn't been assassinated. Let me tell you how many historians, how the attitude of historians about this question. A very good friend of mine, Robert Cowley, he's a very gifted editor. He did three books called What If, and I contributed essays to all three of them, and they were all about what if this happened in other parts of American history and so forth. And one of the things that he had been an editor for a long time, so he knew historians everywhere. And so he had everybody involved in proposing ideas and so forth. And this was the one idea that he wanted some historian to write about. What if Lincoln lived? He couldn't get one historian to do it. It was so forbidding and so complicated and so intimidating, I think it is, to say, it comes down to this. Could he have reconciled the two sections? Could he have worked out a way that so the blacks could have moved into some kind of acceptance of their reality and so forth? We only get a glimpse of it, this is, I have something about it in the Disease in the Public Mind. It's called Lincoln's Last Speech, and it's very little known. On the day after Grant accepted Lee's surrender, there was a huge crowd. When the news reached Washington, a huge crowd flooded onto the White House, and it was at night. And they started yelling, speech, 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 and whammo, the window came up looking over the front portico of the White House, and there was President Lincoln. And here's why Lincoln was known among his staff as the tycoon. He really was always thinking. And he had a speech already. It was all written out. And his little son, Tad, sat under the window, and as Lincoln read the one page after another, he dropped it, and Tad would grab it before it hit the floor. And there was a reporter who was a very close friend of his and stood right there taking notes on the speech, too, because he wanted to get this into the newspapers as fast as possible. And he, in this speech, did give a very interesting glimpse of how he thought the South could be reconciled. He, first of all, said, intelligent blacks will get the vote. In New Orleans, for instance, there was a huge black middle class and upper class even, that free, they had been free for a long time. And so intelligent blacks like them would get the vote. And then everybody who had served in the Union Army, every black man in the service, they would get the vote. And he had a formula worked out how the states, if they gave the blacks the vote, they would then be accepted back into the Union as equal states and so forth. There was a lot of problems connected to it, of course, but it was a rather crude but nonetheless meaningful outline. And I think, but the ending of it is what I loved best. After he told this whole story of what he was going to do and all that, and saying, I may not be right about this, but we'll do our best and so forth. Finally, at the end, the crowd all applauded, and they all yelled, a song, a song, we want a song. And the Marine Band was right there. And so everybody thought Lincoln was going to say, I want to hear the Battle Hymn of the Republic or John Brown's Body or something like that. He said, oh, I'd love a song. And he picked Dixie. It was one of his favorite songs. He was from Kentucky. But he was saying here, we're all one country again, and Dixie can be our favorite song if you feel like it. Yeah. So thank you again.